Morning, everybody. This is the earliest I've been up in a long time. Welcome to apparently the last class of machine learning for many body physics for I guess this cycle of Psi, 2022-2023. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm Roger Melko, professor at the University of Waterloo and associate faculty here at Perimeter, where I run the Perimeter Institute of Quantum Intelligence Lab, aka Pickle, right across the street. So for your last class, Lauren and I thought we'd subject you to maybe a little bit of, maybe a wrap up in terms of, maybe bringing some of the material that you've learned kind of on the chalkboard, to light in the perspective of research that's been done. Not just, here, but mostly focusing on, I think, people who are in those seats, right? Years before you, the Psi students, who really contributed a lot to the field of machine learning in physics. So I'm going to start with kind of machine learning from my own perspective. I'm a condensed matter theorist by training, and lots of people ask me why there's so many condensed matter people in this field of machine learning. So I just want to give you a bit of insight into that. Then I'll dive into just maybe kind of disorganized overview of some of the research that's been going on here since roughly 2015, 2016 in the field of machine learning. And I'll focus on different themes. So some of the tools that you've developed on the supervised and unsupervised learning side, and more recently, maybe the language model side of machine learning. But I also want to highlight a different topic or theme, which is the role that industry has played, sort of both in transferring technology into the field, but also as a motivating factor in sort of choosing the problems that we work on. So I think there's no denying that machine learning as a field, is really driven in a large part by these industry connections. And then depending on time, I'll talk a little bit about what I believe the frontier is in this field of research, unapologetically focusing on stuff that I'm doing. So that'll be the last part of this. So machine learning and condensed matter physics. I believe there's a very strong parallel between I call it here the crisis, the explainability crisis in condensed matter, and topics of, I would say interpretability and explainability in AI. So I first encountered, and I think many of us first encountered, what I'm calling this explainability crisis in the field of high TC superconductivity, which, these were materials that were discovered in the mid-80s, 1986, 1987 type. So the mid-80s were a remarkable time for condensed matter theory, in large part because people started to really appreciate that strongly correlated physics produced, fundamentally different results than free, non-interacting theories. So high TC superconductivity, it's you've probably heard about it before. It's these ceramic materials that have an unconventional type of superconductivity. It's high temperature because you don't need liquid helium. You can basically cool them down to superconducting temperatures with liquid nitrogen. YBCO is a prototypical material, kind of here in the middle, where there's all sorts of stuff going on, but the superconductivity is in the copper oxygen planes, which you can abstract into sort of a two-dimensional grid of, interacting orbitals, which is very accurately described by what we call the Hubbard model. So H is the Hamiltonian, minus T, so T is called the hopping parameter, use the interactions, and C dagger and C, which run over the indices IJ of the lattice, and also sigma, which is the spin index. So spin, these are electrons, they can have spin up or spin down. This is a quantum mechanical second quantized Hamiltonian. This is kind of like the kinetic energy term. It describes electrons hopping. So very simply, if there's a electron hops from site I to J, there's a associated creation and destruction operator for that charge. And then there's an interaction term U, which looks at the number of electrons of, say, spin up and the number of spin down on a given site, and associates this repulsive energy. It seems very simple, and it is very simple. And the reason I, you know, even though it might be unfamiliar, the reason I write it down is it's really a Hamiltonian that can be motivated directly from microscopic theory. So I would even go as far to say that we have a theory of everything. We already have the theory of everything for matter and materials. So if you don't count radiation and some other exotic stuff, you know, we have quantum field theory. We have, you know, the idea of basically many-body quantum mechanics. And we can write this Hamiltonian down. We're fairly confident that it describes, again, everything in some sense. So what is the explainability crisis? The explainability crisis is going from the microscopic interactions, which again are motivated directly from our exquisite knowledge of, you know, quantum electrodynamics and quantum field theory and physics at the microscopic length scale, to the macroscopic scale, which is superconductivity. So even though we know that we understand the interactions, you know, even though we know the theory of everything, we can't explain high temperature superconductivity in the cuprates. And it's not just the cuprates. It's other strongly correlated materials, fractional quantum Halls often cited, topological materials, things like that. So there's certainly a crisis in condensed matter physics in that, is it us? We're not smart enough? Or is there some reason why superconductivity and these other macroscopic phenomena emerge with mechanisms that we don't fully understand? And I would add to it that it's not just us and our inability to write down, you know, equations that sort of govern the connection of the microscopic to the microscopic to the macroscopic scale. There's also computational complexity, I would say, barriers. Okay, so even our best computers, and ask Emily Huffman, a postdoc here who works on the Hubbard model, even our best computers and our best algorithms to date are unable to, I'd say, recreate this emergence or to fully understand this emergence from the microscopic to the macroscopic. And if you want to draw another analogy, it's very similar to the inability of a classical computer to simulate a quantum computer, right? So interacting electrons, interacting qubits, what's the difference? Okay, there are some, of course, slight differences in Hamiltonians and how we prepare gates and so on. But really, you know, we're used to the idea that we can't simulate fully a quantum computer. So it's a very similar problem here. And, you know, it's, again, a question of not just our own, I'd say, analytical ability or inability. It's also a question about whether we're computationally able to make these connections. So Phil Anderson, who recently died, who was, you know, some would say the godfather of our field, condensed matter, won the Nobel Prize for various things, worked on, of course, the Higgs mechanism, the Anderson-Higgs mechanism, I guess we should call it, all sorts of seminal contributions to field theory and you know, low energy physics, if you want to call it that. He really identified this, you know, this explainability crisis as one of the core, I'd say, motivating factors for condensed matter theory. So the ability to reduce, this is a quote, everything to simple fundamental laws, like the Hubbard model, does not imply the ability to start from those laws and reconstruct, okay, the universe is ambitious, you know, how about superconductivity? But you get the point. So Anderson really pushed against this, you know, reductionist paradigm where the goal of physics is just reduce, try to solve, quantum gravity and we're done. He really said, that's not enough. You know, we live in a world of emergence. Everything that we sort of encounter in real life has some, I'd say, connection to this crisis. And he even went as far to say that the constructionalist or the reductionalist hypothesis breaks down when confronted with the twin difficulties of scale and complexity. And I think these are two important themes, not just for condensed matter, but certainly for machine learning. And this is why I bring it up. You know, scale, we're seeing large scale emergence now with language models. I mean, when I first gave these lectures, we didn't have large language models. And we argued about scale and whether or not we could scale, you know, machine learning, I guess, algorithms to, you know, produce new phenomenon like that. And now it's obvious. We have existence proofs that there are emergence in large language models. So, you know, it's very, very relevant now. And talking to people in the machine learning community, this concept of emergence, and I should have put it on this slide. I literally don't have it anywhere. But emergence as a concept is being openly discussed very widely in the machine learning community now. And again, just to reemphasize, you know, in some sense, this is the first level where the problem of emergence occurs. It's going from, it's in physics. It's going from the fundamental laws that govern electron interactions to the macroscopic phenomena that we observe in condensed matter. And then there's higher levels of emergence. You know, you get chemistry and biology, and then you get whatever computers that you connect, and then you get the internet and memes and society and stuff like that. But this is the lowest level of emergence, basically, that occurs in physics. So Phil Anderson, we're going to come back to the concept of emergence, but just to highlight other contributions of condensed matter physicists, and there's been many in machine learning, I would also point to John Hopfield. So John Hopfield won the Buckley Prize, which is condensed matter's top prize, in 1968. John Hopfield's still around. I think he's at Princeton. He won the Buckley Prize for the joint work combining theory and experiment, understanding those light matter interactions. Doesn't seem all that relevant for machine learning. But what he really did was start, I'd say, the whole field of what we now call generative modeling. And of course, if you're thinking of, GPT, the first letter, G, is generative, right? So the generative models developed by Hopfield were very physical in some sense. And, just to start talking about student contributions, if you want to learn more about Hopfield networks, which are really just fully connected Ising models, I don't know if you cover them in class, but here's an Ising model. Each green dot is a Ising spin, and each one of these lines is a weight or an interaction connecting. This is fully visible. Hopfield was the first to really push this, and he pushed it as a model of associative memory. So how you form memories, in this case through, you would do it through optimizing a cost function, and also retrieve memories with some sort of degree of association. So I'd encourage you to look at Giacomo's thesis, which is remarkable. But Hopfield, who's, again, in some sense a godfather of the field of machine learning, never mind condensed matter, had a really interesting research career, and, just to maybe cherry pick a little bit of this quote, his research meandered from hard physics to neuroscience, and you hear a lot about neuroscience as a kind of inspiration for neural networks, of course, and he really became interested in constructing artificial neural networks to recreate functions of the brain. And so, you can go on and sort of read this and how it led to deep learning and so on. But you have these two sort of, have this idea of emergence and scale, and you have these ideas that came from biology and neural networks and so on. So I'd say condensed matter physicists have really been a conduit for combining a lot of these concepts in the past. That was just my real quick motivation for why condensed matter physicists seem to be teaching this class. But here we are. So I want to kind of jump ahead in time to maybe 2015, 2016. And what was going on in that period? So AlexNet had come out in 2013, which is a convolutional neural network that really defined deep learning. So it really solved the computer vision or image recognition problem. Okay, and so a lot of research around that time was really focused on this problem of vision. Now we focus on language models. It hasn't even been that long. But we're completely focused on language models. But the concept of supervised learning, computer vision, and so on was a really hot topic sort of right around the time that Perimeter students, the Sci students yourselves, really started getting into this. So I would actually point, for my second point, the role of industry connections in research, I'd really point to some early papers that, combined the strengths of Perimeter and the amazing students here in the University of Waterloo with all that was going on in sort of Canadian industry. And people often ask me, how did I first get into machine learning? It was really through this paper. So Bogdan Kolchitsky was a PhD student at the time working with me, and he did an internship with with D-Wave out in Vancouver. They were both in Vancouver at the time. And so if you don't know D-Wave, it's a 25-year-old quantum computing company that builds basically a type of quantum annealing system that looks like an Ising model in some sense. And so Bogdan came back to me at some point and he said, this is what we're working on. It's these Boltzmann machines. We want to implement these things in D-Wave. And I was like, you know, what's a Bulls machine? You know, what's going on here? It was just a crazy time. So Mohamed Amin, who's still the lead scientist at D-Wave, had really, you know, been searching for, in some sense, an application for the machine, and came across through all their industry connections and contacts, you know, this concept of generative models with Boltzmann machines. And so this was, you know, and I mean, you've studied Boltzmann machines and restricted Boltzmann machines in the past, in this class. So really, you know, it's very similar to a Hopfield network. You have sigma z variables, you have kind of weights, biases, but in addition, you have a transverse field. So what D-Wave gives you is this quantum mechanical transverse field. And there's still a lot of interest in whether or not you can get speed up, you know, in these conventional generative models, you know, using quantum tunneling, if you will. And so that was kind of the original motivation by D-Wave. But, you know, this is certainly an architecture and a field that very much took off in physics. And I would, again, claim that without the, you know, interactions or the collaborations with industry, these types of concepts, I think, may not have landed in physics as soon as they did. So I believe we're ahead of the curve in some sense, you know, because of these types of industry connections. And I'll come back to that theme. So again, you know, just about, you know, thinking about the ecosystem here at the time, that was, you know, took us a long time to get that paper out, 2016. There was a lot going on. Juan and Miles Studemeyer were sitting in an office here, you know, thinking about tensor networks and supervised learning and all sorts of stuff that you learned about in this class. Giacomo Torlai, who I mentioned, you know, in regard to Hopfield, he became obsessed with Hopfield. Really, you know, just through conversations with, you know, us at work and Bogdan and other people, I really started to think about, you know, how these Boltzmann machines could be used with physics data. You know, so not a quantum Boltzmann machine, but just the conventional Boltzmann machine, the, you know, they originally used for, you know, generative pre-training of deep neural networks before AlexNet. So before convolutional neural networks came out, these things were in wide use. And we, you know, we sat around batting around the idea of, like, could we learn, you know, the ground states or the thermal states, the thermodynamic states of something like a two-dimensional Ising model in a Boltzmann machine? And there's a lot of, you know, debate about whether this made sense, whether it was like a self-evident truth that you should be able to, you know, just take data that was produced by something like a classical Monte Carlo, feed it into a Boltzmann machine. And finally, at some point, I said, let's just do it. And, you know, so Giacomo produced this remarkable paper that, you know, really he just constructed a restricted Boltzmann machine, ran a classical Monte Carlo in the Ising model, and basically showed, I mean, I won't go through it, but you can converge all the thermodynamic estimators to the exact values being trained from that data, you know, as long as you had a sufficiently expressive machine. So this is the number of hidden units, and you see you need enough hidden units to represent your physical state. And it, you know, this again gets to the question of how many physical units or how many hidden units are enough to represent physical states. How do these machines scale? You know, what happens in the emergence limit if you scale these machines to larger and larger sizes? You know, these are all valid questions that we were thinking about way back then, almost 7 years ago now, but are very relevant today. So that whole, you know, balance between supervised and unsupervised learning, or I guess the kind of like the different directions that you could imagine taking, you know, we were thinking about quite early here at Perimeter. On the sort of supervised learning side, so of course, you guys have looked at using feed-forward neural networks to discover things like order parameters and so on. Now very almost basic demonstration of the power of supervised learning. Pedro Ponte was a PSI student and was continued in his PhD. He was PSI, right, Lauren? Yeah, before his PhD. You know, he stayed for his PhD working with myself and Dima Bannon. And he also got interested in this idea of supervised learning, but also this question of interpretability or explainability. And you know, Pedro came to me with this idea of using kernel methods and these support vector machines for really, you know, not just, I would say, numerically reproducing estimators like here. Okay, here's the order parameter, magnetization, right? Well, it's just something that you know, measure out of the Boltzmann machine, but really discovering the mathematical form of the order parameters in more complex systems. And so Pedro found an ingenious way of using the kernel in a support vector machine, which in some sense defines this optimal hyperplane. So it's finding the hot versus the cold clusters and figuring out how to separate them in space. And using this to extract a mathematical form for the order parameter, so in this case, magnetization squared, which he could then plot as a function of temperature and compare to exact results. So, again, a really sort of interesting exercise in what I would call explainability. And what this work on support vector machines taught me was the tension between explainability, so finding a mathematical form for an order parameter or a function of interest, and scalability. Okay, so in these architectures, you lack explainability. If you look at weights, or if you look at a feedforward neural network and look at the weights and try to figure out how the weights should be interpreted in terms of the order parameter, it's very difficult to do at scale. Whereas these things give you an interpretable order parameter, but you can't scale them. So typically you can get stuck at something like, what did he do here? 40 by 40 or 100 by 100 if you wanted to burn a bunch of GPU time or something like that, okay? So I think this is something that you should take away from this class. Is if you have a scalable model, is it explainable, or does it have the potential to be explainable, and vice versa? Are these two things, conflicting or competing ideas? And I don't think I have an answer for you, but it's certainly just something to, I'd say, keep in mind. By the way, interrupt with questions. I'm not here to deliver a sermon. Happy to have some discussion. Another thing I like about Pedro's work. Was that, people often ask me, or maybe less so now, but in the early days, what has machine ever done? What has machine learning ever done for the field? Machine learning hasn't discovered the mechanism for high temperature superconductivity yet. So what has it done? When you trailbreak in a new field of physics, which all of you will do, I hope, you get all sorts of comments from this is obvious to this is stupid, to everything in between, right? So we were often dealing with the question of what is this good for? What is machine learning good for? And I always point to this paper because this idea of finding interpretable, mathematical forms for order parameters was actually quite widely used in subsequent years and still to this day by many groups working in condensed matter, led largely by Lota Paulette in Munich, who have complicated models where the order parameters they're still local, but they're actually very complex. They're either some sort of complex ordering wave vector or some tensor structure or something like that. So I just throw this page up here because, here's something of interest to condensed matter physicists, which is these generalized, Kitaev honeycomb models. There's all sorts of exotic phenomena that can emerge in these things. And what Lota showed is by using Pedro's support vector machine techniques, he could pull out the mathematical representation of very complex sort of tensorial order parameters, from these strongly interacting systems. So I argue that these methods are already being used very widely to give interpretable access to new discover, I would say, new order parameters in many different cases. They've also supervised methods. I don't have slides for this, but have also been widely used to discover correlations in things like atomic gas microscope experiments, where complicated models, even like the Hubbard model, have been produced. And if you went to Annabelle Bort's talk, she talked a little bit about this at the end. So I'd say there's actually a lot of discovery happening now with machine learning. And we kind of went from comments like, will this ever be good for anything, to Yeah. Now it's obviously good for many things, and what do we do next type of thing. So I guess my point is, just keep on keeping on if you think you have a good idea. On the topic of supervised versus unsupervised learning, did you guys do PCA? Yeah, so you know this paper by Lei Wang. Another sort of remarkable, I'd say, just interpretation of what machine learning can do, with physics data. And of course you can separate, right, depending on depending on the different temperatures of the samples, you can separate using PCA, different regions of, I would say configurations that are being produced for the Ising model. And I'd say there's also been a lot of work on similar ideas to this here at Psi and at Perimeter. The use of PCA and related things like T-SNE, do I have it here? Yeah, Matthew Duchenne, who's a PhD student now here with Ray LaFlamme and Juan. Matthew's Psi essay is really remarkable in the sense that he used variations of what Lei Wang showed us to discover the symmetry of order parameters in the Q-state POTS model. Okay, so if you haven't studied the POTS model, the two states POTS model is the Ising model, three states POTS model, four states POTS model. At some point, the phase transition in the POTS model becomes first order, and the order parameter has a higher Zn symmetry, I guess if you want to call it that. So for the four state POTS model at low temperatures, at any temperature, you can see a separation of four low temperature ordered states, right, which is the symmetry that's spontaneously broken, versus the high temperature cluster and so on. So again, I think these ideas of supervised, and in this case, unsupervised learning, have a lot of powerful potential, and a lot of development has come, from Psi students here. Another concept that was being looked at quite a bit, I'd say in the early days of deep learning, was the connection between the depth of a neural network, and I'm thinking like a convolutional neural network, but any sort of feed-forward neural network might also apply where you have multiple length scales, and the renormalization group. So we don't show it much anymore, but there used to be, I should have dug it up, there used to be pictures going around that showed the different sort of latent layers or the hidden layers of a feed-forward neural network, a deep neural network that was used for facial recognition, and the kind of structures that emerge at each level. Level one was the pixels going into the neural network. Level two, you would see some sort of light and dark edges. Level three was like eyes and ears and noses. And level four was like fully constructed faces or something like that. This was a big deal again 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And people were thinking about, what does it mean to kind of, I guess, separate, have this hierarchy of length scales and of features that emerge in deep neural networks. And there was a lot of work on connecting these concepts to concepts in the renormalization group, largely again by people like David Schwab and Miles Studemeier have looked at this. So Stavros, when he was here as a Psi student, teamed up with Matt Beach and basically looked at how you could use concepts of renormalization group and connect them to machine learning in very concrete ways. And so he found the core idea here in Stavros's paper was to take an image and to imagine doing a super resolution transformation on it. So if you have a low resolution image and you want to make it higher resolution, how do you do that? Well, so what Stavros came up with was a kind of machine learning prescription to do that with configurations of the Ising model drawn at the critical point. And so if you know about criticality, there's a length scale that diverges at any second order phase transition. Which means that you have some sort of special power law decay of correlation functions and no sort of unique length scale past the UV and IR limits. And so what Stavros did was parlay that into a way of taking, say small images, like a 16 by 16 pixel, Ising model at the critical point and super resolving it up to larger and larger sizes. And so there's a very firm prescription about how to do that using renormalization groups ideas. But you can see how powerful a concept that would be if we could generalize that. It would be applicable for all sorts of condensed matter problems that we do numerically, but also quantum computers, where you have a small quantum computer with just a fixed number of qubits, and you want to imagine what the output might be on a larger quantum computer, right? So again, these ideas connecting physics, deep learning, renormalization group, all these things really come together in this field that we're working on. I'll just mention again another Psi student, Anna Golubeva, who worked with me for her PhD, who also looked at a lot of these and related problems. She actually wasn't just interested in sort of super resolution, but was interested in, I guess, the information content of the neural network that represents images like these. And she went back to a restrictive Boltzmann machine, and she looked at the critical point and away from the critical point, and tried to, again, interpret what's going on with the weights and in some cases, the biases of in her architecture, the restrictive Boltzmann machine. And so I'm just relating these two things because she noticed at criticality, the weights and biases of a restrictive Boltzmann machine are sort of all distributed in some non-trivial way, which precludes what people now call pruning. So here's a picture of an RBM where the weights that connect the visible to hidden layer, if they're large, are thick lines, and if they're small, they're these really thin lines you can barely see. So if you have a gapped state, if you're on the high temperature or the low temperature side of a critical point, you can prune these small weights without losing too much information. Okay, but if you're right at the critical point, that pruning procedure becomes much more delicate. Actually, any sort of pruning of these weights can lead to a loss in correlation functions here. So here's the two-point function of the criticalizing model. As you prune and prune away, you basically lose information about the true correlations in the system. So again, it gets back into this idea of scalability, interpretability, and so on. If you want to study these types of systems at scale, the neural network that represents them in many different, it's very robust. You know, it can be feed-forward neural networks, it can be restrictive Boltzmann machines. It's very difficult to sort of, I would say, prune the weights and biases down into something that's basically interpretable in a large length scale limit. So again, we're seeing this. I get the ideas of emergence and scalability, I think, just starting in these study by these Psi students. Anna Golubeva, she
did. Roger.
Yep. Hello.
Sorry. Are there particular neural networks that work well in the region of critical time, near the critical point?
Are there methods that work particularly well right at a critical point? Is that your question?
Yes.
There's definitely methods that work poorly. I'd say it's a question of scaling again. Let me skip ahead here. Did I have Dan Sahayek's work? Yeah. So it's largely a question of scaling. So here's a generative model again. So here's a restrictive Boltzmann machine that we've taken critical configurations of, in this case, it's a transverse fieldizing model, so it's a quantum model. And actually, we've trained it from configurations both at criticality and away from criticality. Okay, so just to answer that question, if I look at the critical point, let me make this bigger. I wasn't going to focus on it, but if I look at the critical point of this model and I ask, how many hidden units are required to faithfully represent, say, the ground state energy or something like that, as a function of the number of spins, okay? At the critical point, which is h over j equals 1, you see you have, in some sense, I guess, the porous scaling, okay? That, the number of hidden units scales, like the black line here, versus the number of qubits or the number of sites, okay? So I don't know if you call that poor performance or good performance. Again, if you're away from the critical point, and at some point if you're very gapped, if you're very highly ordered, either this is on the high field side or the low field side, you basically need a constant number, at some point. At some point, probably 2 or something like that, hidden units to fully represent the state. So these methods, what's better, what's worse? I mean, I think it's largely a question of scaling, right? For me, anyway. How poorly or how well do, the neural network resources scale at a critical point? And so RBMs have this linear scaling of the number of hidden units with the number of sites for this specific model. But other architectures might have slightly better scaling. We suspect that recurrent neural networks have better scaling for representing these types of wave functions, but we don't actually have a study like this. So I'm just saying I don't have a firm answer to your question, but it is an interesting area of study. By the way, you can think about expressibility, but you can also think about sample complexity. So here's the sample complexity required, you know, to reconstruct the critical state of the transverse fieldizing model for different cube number of qubits n. And okay, there's some functional form that I'm not talking about. But again, you can produce plots like this for almost any physical state and ask, what are the resources required of a neural network in order to learn that state? And so these days they call this, you know, they literally just call this scalability or scaling studies in machine learning. But of course, we here at Perimeter were doing it, you know, before it was cool. So sorry, that's as good as an answer I have off the top of my head.
I see. Thanks.
Let me jump ahead. Yeah. So all sorts of other interesting stuff happened here at Perimeter. Anna and Matt Beach studied the ability to learn topological phase transitions. So what I was just showing you was conventional, you know, Wilson-Fisher fixed point, you know, ISI model type transitions. There's been a lot of work on, you know, POTS models, like I showed you. XY models that have emergent Kosterlitz-Thouless type behavior. You could ask questions about, you know, whether you learn topological features or other defects, and whether you can combine, you know, or interpret, I guess, what's going on in the neural network as learning vortex, anti-vortex, unbinding and unbinding. Dan Sahayek, who was a student here, now he's at Santa Barbara, did a really interesting study on persistent homology for looking for loop structures. He looked at gauge theories, but we were motivated by machine learning to look at gauge theories because, I was like, well, can we use machine learning to detect topological order? And, you know, through that process, Dan actually came up with some pretty impressive methods in algebraic topology for learning loop structures. And so I think even the motivation to look at data and to try to uncover structures has been very powerful, very powerful paradigm in machine learning. A lot of breakthroughs that came out of Perimeter, came from PSI, but we also have all sorts of amazing graduate fellows who visit. So Michael Albergo, I'd like to point out, you know, he was a visiting grad fellow at the Pickle who, right before the pandemic, overlapped with Fiala Shanahan, who was a Emily Noether fellow here. And they combined to come up with this idea of flow-based normalizing flows, let me say that, you know, normalizing flows for the study of quantum field theories. So normalizing flows, you know, very simply, you have some sort of Gaussian that's easy to sample from, and there's some sort of function that you learn that transforms it into a more complex distribution that might be something of interest in physics. Normalizing flows were used widely in machine learning, but first adopted, as far as I know, into physics by Michael Albergo and Fiala and co-workers who now have a whole industry based around flow-based models, going on at iFi and at CCQ and Flatiron in New York City. So again, just something that, you know, Perimeter is really good at, I think, in some sense, is bringing people together, and coming up with new ideas that seed whole fields. So if you look at flow-based generative models, in high energy physics or lattice gauge theories or lattice QCD, you'll see a lot of work by these people. And it all started at Perimeter. Just to get back to the industry connection, to wrap things up, I really like this paper by Elizabeth Benowitz, who was a Psi student, who was sort of our first sort of industry, did our first industry intern, I guess, if you want to call it that. In Psi. And Elizabeth worked, and so, you know, Florian Hopfmuller and Bogdan Kolchitsky and Juan worked with Puya on this paper in collaboration with OneQubit, who sits with us at the Pickle, but is a quantum computing startup based out of Vancouver. And I think they found just a really innovative, kind of training paradigm for generative models using real quantum computing data, which is something we still think about today. What Elizabeth showed was that you could take a quantum computer, which is prepared a certain state, and take the measurements out of that, and to do something we've done for a long time, like I showed you Giacomo Torlai first did, is to reconstruct the state in some generative model. Now, fine, you can do that, but if your data has imperfections in it, like noise or so on, you're basically going to reconstruct the probability distribution that underlies that noise and everything else. So what Elizabeth showed was that you could take that trained generative model and apply a few variational steps, which they call post-processing, using the variational principle, to really, if you want, sort of anneal or push out all of the errors that are associated with the experiment. Okay, so when you guide by the Hamiltonian in the learning process, you can really get rid of all the problems of the data that might come from an imperfect machine. So they call this neural error mitigation. I think it's a very powerful idea in many cases. And it really highlights, okay, number one, the flexibility of these neural network architectures. One thing that I haven't talked about too much, but maybe you learned about, is the concept of using them for variational wave functions. What neural networks provide us is systematically improvable onsots. So like what I'm showing here is the number of hidden units scaling with the number of qubits. You know, before neural networks, something like this would be very difficult to do. If you had a variational onsots, it's not always obvious how you systematically scale the expressive power of that onsots. But with neural networks, it's completely obvious. If you have something like an RBM or a feedforward neural network or a CNN or something like that, you have a latent space. And that latent space can be systematically increased, right, by increasing something like the number of hidden units. So that systematic improvability plus the ability of training both from data, which is what neural networks are meant for, but also variationally, I'd say, has opened up an entire new paradigm of training. And it started, again, this is just 2021, this paper here at Perimeter. Really, to get to my last topic, which is the frontier of machine learning, I would say very much started with this paper and subsequent follow-ups. Here's one by Steph Sizcek, Skylar Moss, and again, another visiting graduate fellow, Matthew Radzahovsky. So you might have heard of Leo Radzahovsky, famous condensed matter professor at University of Boulder. This is his son, Matthew, who Leo sent up here to straighten his life out. And Matthew really taught us how to take recurrent neural networks, which I've been showing you a lot of RBMs. He really produced one of our first codes for RNNs, which could do exactly this. I would call it hybrid training, where you train both from data and also from the variational principle. And so this paper, which again came out not that long ago, really showed that this paradigm is very powerful in enhancing the data that comes from noisy quantum computers. You have a noisy quantum computer, it's producing data. You take that data, you put it into some sort of RNN function, and I'll show a bit more data later. But you really improve that data, and you also improve the variational onsots by feeding it through a neural network. So again, all sorts of, I'd say, groundbreaking work coming from Perimeter. And let's not forget, in order to do this, the architectures have to be developed. And of course, you heard from Mohammed, and he told you all about autoregressive models and all sorts of things. Let's pause and give Mohammed and the other authors of this paper, including Lauren, all the credit they deserve for really introducing a new language-based, architecture. All right, I'm overusing the word, but paradigm in the field of wave function onsots. So now, as far as we understand, in 2023, the recurrent neural network onsots introduced by Mohammed, first studied in PSI, but also studied during his PhD, is the single most powerful onsots that we have currently trained both on synthetic data that we've produced with quantum Monte Carlo and other methods, and on real quantum computing data, and also trained variationally. So again, I love showing this. This is some work Mohammed did last year. I showed this at Flatiron to Steve White himself, who invented DMRG. Here's the energy of a two-dimensional recurrent neural network, minus the DMRG, which is state-of-the-art, variational wave function, if you want to call it that. And as this line goes, this is energy difference, so as it goes from red to green, the two-dimensional recurrent neural network starts beating the DMRG in terms of the lowest energy obtained on some highly non-trivial model. So again, here's neural network technology or language model technology developed here at Perimeter by people who used to sit in those seats. I would say, you know, really changing the world in terms of simulation of strongly correlated electron systems. And again, the goal of these types of Hamiltonians, just like the Hubbard model, is to understand the emergent, you know, ordering patterns and the emergent physics which comes out, you know, based on these microscopic rules. So that's my pitch for recurrent neural networks, which again, to date, are our most powerful wave function onsets. Maybe for the last 5 minutes, let me just, you know, maybe dream a little bit about where I think that field is going and where hopefully some of you and maybe other sci students in the future will contribute to, you know, the frontier of this field. So of course I had a bunch of GPT examples. Let me cherry pick one. This is one I showed to the physics department professor colleagues. This is in the GPT-4 paper. Here's a physics problem, which I can't read because it's in French. GPT-4 was just fed the pixels of this image and asked to solve it. And, you know, it came up with a solution, which is, you know, this is a visual input prompt. Could you imagine? Okay, this is wrong, but it's not wrong enough that, you know, I would certainly waste my time marking it, right? if it landed on my desk, I would be like, is this right? So it's just, I mean, we laugh at the humanities because their field is being upended by GPT, but it's certainly completely possible that undergraduate teaching in physics could be upended by GPT. Here's another one from that paper. Here's the GRE. Who wrote the GRE? None of you guys? You wrote it? Let's see. GRE verbal 99th percentile. It's obviously beat me in all the GRE categories here, which is, you know, again, here we are, 2023. What's the difference in these large language models and the RNNs that we're currently using? One thing in that scale. It's just scale. And transformers, which are the T in GPT, I mean, number one, they're pre-trained because they're expensive to train. We typically train a model and that, you know, it takes us, a few weeks or a month, and then we use it for something. And then we train another model. But if your models are too big, if you have too many hidden units, that training becomes more and more expensive, right? So what is GPT? Generative pre-training. You just take the generative model and you pre-train it and pre-train it and pre-train it, and you get it down into its local, you know, local, I guess, optimization funnel or whatever you call it, and then do a bit of prompting to find the actual global minimum. So how big are these models? GPT-3 was, in its biggest iteration, 175 billion parameters. So that's weights. Think of that as weights. And GPT-4, they didn't release. But, you know, everyone says it's some order of a trillion parameters in that model. A trillion parameters, okay? So generative pre-trained transformers. A few weeks ago, we were at Aspen, and somebody was saying it costs $100 million to train. And I think that's basically, like, the electricity to run the GPUs. So they're parameterized probabilistic models, and they do the same thing that the RNNs do. Again, you know, they're autoregressive, number one, which means that there's a sequence defined in a transformer, which is usually the sequence of tokens or words or whatever. But that sequence is broken down, you know, if you want the joint probability distribution, into a product of conditionals, okay? And that, I mean, there's debate about this. Yann LeCun says that this is not where the power comes from for these generative models. But from what we observe in physics models, that autoregressive property is very, very important. As Mohammed might have told you, it gets rid of the need to sample with Markov chains. So what have physicists done, or us here at Perimeter, sci students like yourself, really just replace the word dictionary, right? There's a one-hot vector encoding a whole bunch of words that you would feed into these language models to output conditional distributions, with a dictionary that consists of the projective measurements of of a qubit or an electron spin or something like that. Very simple substitution. All sorts of things are possible once you do this, including implementing symmetries and doing different sort of training paradigms and things like that. But just to, you know, since she's not here to defend herself, you know, just to highlight some of the work that's currently coming out of these generative models, here is real data that came from a 16 by 16 a Rydberg atom experiment at Harvard University. We got 1,000 shots from the experimentalists. So that's 256 qubits, 1,000 shots. And Skylar Moss trained a two-dimensional recurrent neural network on this data. And the I should have put more slides here. The orange line is the result of that training. So this is the energy of the model as a function of the training step. And if you just look at the orange for a minute, you basically train to some value, and then you basically start to overfit. And we've used a model that we think is big enough to capture this wave function. The exact value we know from Ijaz Mirali's quantum Monte Carlo, which sits down here. And here's another way of training the model variationally. So you can also train these models with variational onsets. It's the blue, and it eventually gets to the right answer if you train it long enough. But what is the green? The green is the result of pre-training. In the same way that GPT is pre-trained, what we do here is we imagine pre-training this RNN on the orange curve, which is the experimental data. But then what we do is we switch the cost function. So every one of these green points that dives down is, I should have just showed you one, is switching the cost function to the variational cost function after pre-training. And what you see is a rapid improvement of performance, okay? So what I'm saying is what we're doing now here, right across the street, is basically exploring this idea of pre-training larger and larger models, not for passing the GRE or whatever, but for using in quantum simulation. And so, again, here we are in March or whatever, 2023, Psi students and University of Waterloo students. Here's Roger, Anna Knorr, down at Harvard right now, working on QERA's device, which came out of Misha Lukin's lab. Literally collecting data from these Rydberg atom experiments, in the laboratories to use as pre-training of what we're going to build here, which is a large language model. I couldn't help but type emergent resurgence, because now we're getting back to the point years and years later when emergence was talked about in condensed matter, where these GPT paradigms, this generative pre-training of models, is being discussed as an emergent phenomenon. And it's very true. If you build these things big enough, they will produce, phenomena that we could never have predicted by looking at their constituent parts, right? If I go back and look at Mohammed's RNN here, and then I imagine what GPT-4 does, it's clearly an emergent property, right? And so there's all sorts of literature coming out now. This is in the machine learning community. Anna Golubeva showed me this. Where people are trying to understand emergence in large language models. And just as a finest, and this could solve things like the Hubbard model, just as a final plug for the pickle, what we decided to do this summer was to try to build the biggest language model we could and pre-train it on this Rydberg atom data. So in the spirit of Perimeter and having visiting graduate fellows work together with us, David Fitzek is here now sitting at Pickle. He's a PhD student at Chalmers University in Sweden, where they're quantum computing experts. And so what he's doing with some Psi students and with Yi Hong, with Ijaz and other people, is building what we're calling Rydberg GPT, which is now it's a transformer, which we're basically scaling to a massive amount of parameters and pre-training on data that Anna Knorr and Roger and other people are going to be collecting down at QERA. And what we're going to do is we're going to use this massive train model that we're going to basically develop over the summer to do things like perform as a variational wave function, or to help the experimentalists maybe understand their future experiments when they come out. So it's a really interesting time, because only yesterday, probably a lot of you saw this open letter telling us to pause training huge models. You just took an ethics class. Should Pickle pause in its training of a large language model on quantum computing data? Seems silly, right? But it's kind of interesting to be in the middle of a debate, as it happens. And I think that's something that's uniquely Perimeter. So hopefully that's a bit of motivation for you guys. I'd like to wrap up by thanking everyone, past and present, who's worked at Pickle on these models. See, there's a huge group of, there's Bogdan and Raj, and oh my God, here's Martin who worked on, here's Giacomo who never got a t-shirt. Oh my God, poor guy. Estelle and Anna, Quan, of course, through his mentorship of students and postdocs, has done so much to advance the field. And so thanks very much for your attention. Questions?
Can you give some more references convergence, but like specifically towards machine learning? Because I know you recommended like the Phil Anderson essay.
Yeah. Laughlin and Pines.
Yep. Good, but like maybe more related to machine learning.
I asked Anna this 2 days ago. I'm like, I'm teaching Psy. I need some references for emergence. So she gave me this one, and she gave me another one that I can throw it in Slack. Yeah. But yeah, it's a debate that, you know, she's at iFi right now with all the machine learning people, and it's certainly a debate that they're just kind of seem to be starting and thinking about. And I'd say in that sense, we're ahead in some way. But it's super interesting. So yeah, I'll get you some references.
How do you pre-train the models?
So we'll pre-train our models. So it's kind of this paradigm. So we'll train them once on a whole bunch of data, okay? And the data will come from all different interactions, different parts of the phase diagram, maybe different sizes and so on. We're gonna try to jam all of that into a much more highly parameterized model than this. I can't remember how many parameters this one has. But the idea is that, I guess you can't really see it here, but you imagine that you're improving your cost function by training. But the more parameters you have, the harder this is. You know, the more training steps it might take. It just stretches out on this axis more and more and more. So when you get to these massive models, and again, what I heard in Aspen was that, and this, somebody do this calculation. Is it feasible? Everyone kept saying that GPT-4 is being trained on an Avogadro's number of floating point operations a week, 10 to the 23. So, I mean, what they're trying to do is they're trying to, you know, basically go down this curve as far as possible. They have a massive, they have a trillion parameters in their language model. And they have to, you know, a trillion parameters just scale this. How much data does it take to get somewhere down this curve, right? And so we're taking that philosophy and we're gonna try to scale a model, build a huge model with a lot of parameters. And then it's like, you're gonna train it with any data you can find. And that's what pre-training is. GPT-4 is, you know, they scraped the entire internet and jammed it into GPT-4. We're gonna get as much training data as we can off of our simulations and off of the, you know, the experiments. And we're gonna just jam it in this model and pre-train it as far down this curve as we can go. So that's the simple answer, I think. That's what pre-training is. And then you can do things after. You can do some supervised learning where you can either, you know, in the GPT context, they call it human alignment. You basically have humans give supervised feedback to the machine. But we have all sorts of other possibilities because we have physics. You know, we have a ground truth and we have a Hamiltonian. And so we can use pre-trained models, I think, in a very flexible way. Ask me again in a year when we've trained the model. Other questions? I guess there's people online. Any questions online?
I guess this is probably like an open question, but how much do you see like the structure of the networks, like their actual configuration, the size of the hidden layers and how they're connected and that? How much does that affect the outcomes of the networks? And I guess this is like a deep rabbit hole. There's infinite number of possibilities, but.
It's a good question. It's kind of where we are now with this, is we're over at Pickle debating how many attention layers and how many blocks and all this type of stuff. So it's, I don't know. I mean, it's the thing with these pre-trained models is once you fix that structure, you know, like if I go back here, once you fix the structure of, here's all the different GPT iterations that had different numbers of parameters. So once you fix it, you can't change it. Because you start training it, and the value's in that training in some sense. So we're trying to be careful, and we'll do Rydberg GPT-1 now. We'll fix the structure, and we'll see how it performs. And then probably we'll do another iteration at some point. But yeah, so I don't have an easy answer for that. It's amazing that that's where all the, you know, it's the training is where the cost is. And then once you're done the pre-training, you just have a bunch of weights and biases. You can just put it on a USB stick and like give it out to people. So it's kind of really remarkable. It's the training that is the expensive part now. Cool.
Okay, well that's all. Thanks, Roger, for a great talk.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And thanks to Lauren for running an amazing class again. Lauren. Thank you very much. All right. Take care, everybody.